Ladies and gentlemen, it was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Read and Buried podcast. I am delighted, or I'm Frankie, I should say that part first, and I'm more excited, clearly, and delighted to be joined by the wonderful Abigail Dean.
Thank you, Frankie. It's lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. I'm so excited to meet you, finally. Having read, I've loved Girl A and the new book, so excited to get into this because wow, what a piece of work. Unbelievable.
Thank you.
Before I do, I've got a little bio that I'm going to read out about you, just in case. I'm sure everybody listening knows who you are already, but just in case, I've got a little short one. So here we go. Abigail Dean was born in Manchester and grew up in the Peak District. She was formerly a Waterstones bookseller and a lawyer for Google. Her first novel, Girl A, was a New York Times and Sunday Times top 10 bestseller and a Kindle number one bestseller. It was chosen as a best book of 2021 by The Times, Financial Times, Guardian, Independent, Stylist, and more. That's already quite a lot, so good to get some more in there. And the rights to Girl A were sold in 36 territories, and a television series is being adapted with Sony, which is pretty cool. That's amazing.
I'm such a massive TV and movie addict I'm excited.
Me too. Oh, we can talk about that in a minute. Absolutely. Her second novel, Day One, is out on the 28th of March. Marty told the reporters that she saw it happen. She saw the gunman enter the hall. She saw her mother die trying to protect them all. That's the version of Day One Marty wishes was true. But strange inconsistencies in her story begin to surface. Details that don't add up. Questions she can't answer. The story ignites. Amidst the media frenzy, conspiracy theorists become obsessed with exposing what really happened. And at the epicenter of it all is a small community changed forever. Survivors crushed by guilt. Families torn in half. Outsiders consumed by the hunt for truth. Each has their own version of Day One. Each must grapple with this tragedy, even as fanatics question whether it really ever really happened at all. But what did Marty really see? And why would she lie? As events spiral out of control, the true story is revealed, piece by shocking piece. Day One is an unflinching and heartbreaking exploration of our obsession with tragedy and what it really means to live it. Outside of writing, Abigail lives in South London with her husband, young child, and cat. As well as being an exceptionally talented and successful writer, she is also very generous with her time, particularly when talking about books and writing, and also has the perfect Bob Fringe combo of dreams. So,
thank you, Frankie. The Bob Fringe has got to get a mention.
Oh my God, it's amazing. I'm so jealous. It's, yeah, you have perfect hair.
Thank you. I'm currently pregnant with my second little
Congratulations.
Boy. And I think it's pregnancy hair. Like, that's what I've had more good hair days in the last few months than in the rest of my life put together. Basically.
That's the perk of pregnancy. I know there aren't many apart from like the resulting child, but like the hair not falling out. Nice.
Absolutely. Yeah. The hair right now, it'll all fall out within, you know, a few months from the birth, and then that'll be a whole different story. But for now, I'm going to swoosh the hair pregnancy out.
Yeah, get that full luscious locks going on. Isn't it fascinating how horrifying and amazing the human body is with the stuff that it does? That is bonkers, right?
Yeah, it's. I think it's such a sort of like visceral, quite, I don't want to say violent state, and that's too much, but I think your body does sort of almost neglect you slightly in pregnancy. Like it had this other being to worry about, and it essentially casts you by the wayside. Like you can get sick, you can, you know, you can sort of go through these various crazy changes with this kind of final goal in mind. It's very, very bizarre. Wow. And sort of, yeah, slightly, I mean, kind of obviously it feels sort of very, I don't know, prehistoric isn't the right word.
Yeah.
But very,
yeah, totally. Like it's like your body knows the sacrifice of parenthood before you actually even have your child. You're instantly
yes,
yeah, truly fascinating. And terrifying, but you are a very brave and strong woman. And congratulations. That's wonderful news. And I long may your full head of hair last, is what I say.
Thank you. Let's hope this head of hair.
Also, for the record, I've seen photos of you not pregnant and your hair still looks good. So I just to make that clear, I think you're just lucky. And it's just, you know, I'm not talking about your hair. We're not here to talk about your hair as much as I would love to talk all about your hair. I'd also really love to talk about the amazing new book that you have got coming out. So excited for day one. And wow, I do you ever read Goodreads?
So no, okay. I do not read Goodreads or Amazon. I think they are, I read them as a reader.
Yeah.
So if I'm thinking about a book, I might read them. Or if I've just finished a book that I adore,
yeah,
I might go to one of those sites. As a writer, I think it is best to stay away because it's a space for readers.
No,
rather than writers.
Fair enough. Completely understand that. The only reason I ask is because I always read through Goodreads before I speak to an author just to see what the consensus is around the book. Very positive, by the way, not that you need to read it yourself. I'm just going to tell you, very positive. But there was one review that really made me chuckle, and it was a 5-star review, by the way, just to give you that context. And the line in it that made me laugh was, "I see that Abigail Dean likes to fictionalize bleak AF tragedies." I was like, that's an interesting way of putting it.
Yeah. I could see that. That was a fair comment.
But you do it in such a beautiful way, I have to say. And it's the thing I love about your books is it's not so much about, and it is about the events that take place, but you write, you're so character driven in your portrayal of these stories. So I feel like you give really good in-depth representation to the people that go through these kinds of tragedies rather than sensationalizing the events that happen.
Yeah, I think it's that it's a case of, for me, what is interesting about some of the terrible things that sort of happen in the world is all of the things which you don't see and which you shouldn't see because they're not for kind of public consumption. Those particular kind of conversations and the kind of quiet moments that follow, that might follow a tragedy, whether it's kind of in the weeks after or in some cases kind of years and decades after. But I think those are the scenes that I'm really interested in, that I think kind of humanize everybody who can be caught up in something like this, which in day one's case is in a school shooting. Yeah, the stories that essentially we don't see and that we aren't told because we don't really have, you know, that they're not, it's not within our interest to be.
Yeah. And same with Gourlay. Obviously, I can see the real life cases that you may have drawn inspiration from your stories. And I guess there are a number of school shootings that you could take your pick from in this day and age, particularly in America. Obviously, the book isn't set there. But how do you balance telling, you know, an exciting, compelling and engaging story with the kind of the more triggering aspects of a story like that?
I think that for me, a big part of it is not focusing on the event itself. I feel very uncomfortable sort of writing something that relished in a way the violence of a particular event. And for me, rather than a particular kind of real life event, I think for day one, what was the kind of question I wanted to grapple with was about conspiracy theories. And it was time and again after a terrorist attack or a school shooting was taking place, there were people who immediately doubted.
Yeah.
Survivors' accounts. And I remember it very much following the Manchester Evening News bombing. And Manchester is my kind of home city. And just being aghast and astonished, really, that the immediate reaction would not be kind of devastation, it would be suspicion.
Yeah.
And that this wasn't coming from a really small fringe minority. It's like a really widespread thing. That it's not people sort of sitting in their basements in a tinfoil hat.
No.
It's people who you know, and it's people you see on Facebook, often friends of friends or relatives. And what makes somebody who appears by all accounts kind of, you know, pretty ordinary go down that rabbit hole to the extent that they, you know, occasionally there is like the harassment of survivors and challenging people's accounts in very confrontational ways. Like, how does that come about for somebody?
Yeah, it's always incredibly shocking when you see that. And I think the internet is a breeding ground, particularly sites like Twitter and other places like that. And you capture that kind of, you represent those online communities, I would say, really well in the book, and the kinds of people, as you say, it's not just people with tinfoil hats anymore. It's real life people in there. And you give a humanity to those people and show how they end up in that kind of world. So how, what was the research process like for that?
It's an odd thing to research,
yeah,
because it is out there. You don't have to look very far.
Yeah.
Past the sites, you know, like Twitter, X, like Reddit, that are sites that I go on anyway.
Mm.
And that is probably not the content that an algorithm is going to serve me, but it's not particularly difficult for anybody to find that content. So I think that was a big part of it, was really trawling the way people speak about disaster. There've obviously been some very, very high profile cases. I think both following the MEN Arena attack, yes, and then following Sandy Hook shooting in the US, where you can see the evidence that was used in those cases, which I guess goes to the sort of heart of this real vitriol against survivors in a kind of deeply distressing way, to be honest. But bear in mind that these people have already suffered kind of pretty unimaginable tragedy, and then following on from that, rather than sympathy or empathy, you're getting attacked and not believed. It's sort of second round of assault, really.
Yeah, I know you're referring to specifically Alex Jones there and his case, and so much admiration and respect for those parents for taking him to court and getting that result, because as if they haven't been through enough, they have to then go through that process. But I guess it was worthwhile in the end, or not really, because there's always going to be doubt around these things, isn't there? It's just horrible.
Yeah. And I think when it came to the kind of conspiracy theorist characters in the book, I wanted there to be a real divide in day one between the people who are influenced by the conspiracies, the people who are sort of taken in by them in a very kind of personal way, and genuinely, I think, wholeheartedly believe that something did not take place, versus the politicians and celebrities who peddle these kind of narratives, but sort of tell these stories really with their own interests in mind. At first, I was trying to work with kind of just one conspiracy theorist character, and it didn't work. I think there's such a sort of spectrum of different people who do believe in conspiracy theories, who are involved in them, but often with very, very different motives as well.
Yeah, and conspiracy theory has definitely become a normal part of society and discourse. So fascinating, isn't it, to see how quickly these things can just transform into something incredibly dark and sinister.
Yeah, and sort of gentle suspicion, I think, turns to spite, very, very...
Yeah.
A spite and blame, I guess, as well. Very, very fast, which again, I think that's a very internet driven thing.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as you said, like coming out, well, you didn't say, but we talked about you writing during the pandemic for Girl A, but like coming out of the pandemic, which was a breeding ground for a conspiracy theory in itself. And then that evolved into the QAnon theories and everything that's kind of grown over the years. And like you say, that demographic went from being people in their mum's basement as the horrible stereotype to your parents sharing them on Facebook.
Yes. Yeah. Because COVID, I think, was such a driver for conspiracy theories. And in my view, in quite a sort of sympathetic way as well, because we were all so isolated. You didn't have the normal checks and balances that you perhaps do in socializing. And if you were already relatively isolated as an individual, it was kind of deeply lonely time. And I also personally, I did feel a real absence of trust in the UK government, which was totally justified.
Yeah.
And I think it's only one further step from actually these people, these leaders are actually quite deceitful and they are arguably pretty incompetent to ascribing that with an actual sort of deeper, more malicious plan.
Mm.
In a way, that gives order to the chaos.
Yes.
So I felt a real kind of understanding as to why people did believe in conspiracy theories at that time, while at the same time maintaining a sort of cynicism because it's just who I am. Yeah,
no, it's a healthy way to live life, especially with the 24-hour news cycle that we're faced with. You've just got to, yeah, really read things and form your own opinions and, yeah, read the research and all that. So anyway, back to your wonderful book. As I find the conspiracy thing fascinating, but your book is equally fascinating. And you have a number of kind of tones of voice and points of view within the book that you're writing from. How was that process for you, writing from those different voices?
They really grew as the books and the editing went on. So initially, it was a book that was very much focused on Trent, who is the conspiracy theorist, yeah, and Marty, who loses her mother in this shooting. And I think as time went on, I wanted that idea that there's this kind of community of voices, and in everybody's story, there are these human foibles and very small acts of guilt or selfishness that people didn't do the right thing on that day. And essentially, you see those acts from the conspiracy theorist perspective as being incredibly suspicious, stacking up to something not being right, to some hidden truth. But through the narratives of the actual town's community, you sort of see that actually that's not the case. It's just humans being humans and failing in different terrible ways, really, that are small, that on another day would be so minor. So that was the driving force, really, that that essentially each of these accounts would in some way, frankly, disprove the conspiracy theorist thinking and instead just tell these very ordinary human tragedies instead.
Yeah, because I think everybody, it's a very relatable thing when reading it, is like you think, oh, if I were in that situation, here's what I would do. But you just don't know until something horrifically tragic happens to you how you'll respond in that moment. So it's a very human thing to be a bit selfish or to do the, you know, not act the way that somebody should act in that situation.
Yes. Yeah. And I think something that, as you said, everybody can empathize with, that with coming up slightly late because you're doing something you would rather be doing, or with thinking a thought that you're kind of deeply ashamed of at a later date, or for saving yourself above somebody else. All of those things just feel like very ordinary human behaviors. But I think that if you have a kind of conspiracy theorist mindset, rather than having that kind of, rather than seeing human weakness, you see a manipulation. Yeah.
God, it's obviously a rich breeding ground for narrative and story as a writer. I mean, I guess there's a lot you can play with there, and you have, really.
Yeah, and I think I wanted there to be as well this kind of contrast of time frames in the book, particularly from Marty's perspective, that you see her in this the immediate kind of confused aftermath of this atrocity, and then you also see her as a much more kind of jaded adult, really to drum home the fact that when this happens, she's a very frightened teenage girl.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, in the kind of conspiracy theorist world, she's quite kind of sexualized. She's seen as a very kind of manipulative figure, but that's not it at all. She's just really frightened. And I think we've all sort of possibly been that girl to some degree, where you do probably look and act a lot older than you are.
Definitely.
But you have no idea what you're doing, whether it's in a relationship or in a particular event. And I really wanted that to be the case for Marty. She's not always a likable character, but I think she's just really young. Like you see that in the contrast with the fact that she's also looking back at some events many years later, and she's a very, very different person then.
Yeah, absolutely. A question I like to ask everyone I speak to, and I'm so curious, given the nature of your books, if you had to be a character from one of your books, who would you be and why?
It's a great question. I mean, none of them are sort of like rolling to be top of the list, I'll be honest.
Unless you're an absolute sadist. Masochist.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would probably be a very, very minor character.
Nice. The postman that walks past the house. Or
exactly. Sort of like third lawyer from the left.
Yeah.
You know, in Girl A, there is a tech There's a sort of tech entrepreneur called Jake who Lex does some work for in her kind of legal capacity. And he's just sold a company for huge amounts
yes.
of money. So maybe I'll take Jake. Like, you know, he's doing well for himself.
Yep.
He's got it going on.
He hasn't experienced massive childhood trauma.
There's no childhood trauma. Yep. There's very little violence. It seems like he's in a relatively decent place.
Yeah, that's a good shout. Okay. Good pick. Yeah, because otherwise it's a little bit bleak, isn't it? On the
Nobody else really, no.
Good, strong choice there. That's the thing. Now, going forward, you have to write a character in each of your books that you could run away and be if you had to have this question at you again.
Yeah, I'll be ready next time. There you go. Book three, it's going to be full of beautiful dream lives.
Well, I've seen through lightly stalking your Instagram that you have turned in your third book now. Your edits are in. Is that correct?
That is right. So my edits aren't in, but the first draft is in. I've got the editorial notes. So it's been a real contrast process to writing Day One, which was a challenge. When I was writing Day One, I was still working full time.
Wow.
Then I had my son, and then was desperately trying to do all those things and failing miserably. So I left my job about a year ago.
Wow.
And so I wrote book three in this very, very different, very focused environment, and with just that being this one sort of intellectual passion. And it's been such a kind of like beautiful writing experience versus Day One, which was a real challenge, and which it just took a long time to get around to because of the structure. You know, there's the external things that were happening, and there's also the internal failings, which were entirely my own. So yeah, a mix of things.
I'm always amazed when I hear of people with, you know, writing the way that you write, the big stories that you're telling, who are working full time at the same time as doing that. How did you balance it for so long?
I think for a long while, it was a lot of work in the evenings and weekends. And that was absolutely fine and pretty manageable until my little boy, Josh, came along. And then it became instantly completely unmanageable.
Of course.
And I think I had pretty misguided ideas that I would be able to write on maternity leave as well.
That didn't happen. But I mean, you don't know till you get there, right? That's a thing. It's tough.
Yeah. And it was quite a strange experience, because it really was the case that I could just not hold a novel in my head in the most literal sense. Like, I would forget what happened from one chapter to the next. So it was sort of, I don't know, very grounding to be like, okay, after a few months of trying this, I totally admitted defeat. And then there was this incredible contrast between the months I'd been trying to write with a small baby at home and the 2 months when he first went to nursery. And I wasn't at work and I didn't have a small child in the house. And suddenly it was a very cliche idea about the clouds parting and suddenly seeing the light and understanding what I was trying to write about, which is always great.
That helps, I'm sure.
Always helps. Always good.
Wow. I mean, it's incredibly impressive, though, that you have done all of this while all that was going on. And I appreciate that this third book was an easier process. But I guess it's, my next question that I'd always like to ask people is, what do you like least and most about the writing process? But I guess it's a changing process for you as you've gone into your third book entirely.
It has been a changing process. I can see common likes and dislikes. I mean, I certainly think probably the best thing about writing being the days when it does go well, and when you look back at what you've produced and have a real sense of sort of pleasure and kind of triumph, I guess, in a way that you've sort of achieved close to what you were intending to. I don't think you ever produce the immaculate chapter that's in your head, because I think by virtue of having to write it, it gets muddied and it changes. And that's part of the kind of pleasure actually of writing is this magnificent book that you have in your head is the one that will never ever get written, because it's sullied just by kind of coming into being. But I think those days are maybe few and far between, but they are really wonderful. And I think there's something to be said as well for there's nobody else. This might be my least favorite part about writing as well. There's nobody else who can do that for you. It does just come from your own head in quite an isolated way.
Mm.
But that also means that it's entirely up to you when it goes wrong too. So I guess it's flip side.
Yeah, I guess silver lining though, that yeah, it's rewarding once you get it out of there.
Yeah, it's very rewarding on those days when things go right. And I'm very much a person who loves the first draft.
Oh yeah, that's unusual.
Yeah. Some people really feel real satisfaction when they've got the, 100,000 words in front of them. I really enjoy the process of writing the first draft and sort of getting to know the characters and finding out, I mean, it sounds like pretentious, finding out where they take you. I think really it's getting to know them better, the people you want to capture. And by default, that changes the novel as it goes along. Whereas I think editing can just be, it's such a chipping away process. I think often you get to the end of the day and you feel, even though you have done stuff, you just feel like, I've only worked on two paragraphs today.
Yeah.
And I don't get the same satisfaction, I suppose.
Do you think as well, because you've come from quite a corporate background in the past, you're used to a cumulative result that indicates a successful workday versus that chipping away process, like you say, which is more concentrated, but still just as important as writing this many words?
Possibly. Yeah, there possibly is a side of it's much easier to get through your to-do list.
Yeah, volume.
As a lawyer, when it's your emails, say, and turning a draft of a sort of short contract. And then when your to-do list is just, write the book or edit the book.
Yeah, that's a bit of a bigger bullet.
It's hard to get satisfaction from. I need the hits more often than that.
Yeah, you have to bite the bullet, as they say. And with your career journey, you obviously start to become a lawyer. That's a lot of study in law. But was writing always the secret goal or dream for you?
It was, especially as a child and a teenager. It was the real dream. I think if you had asked me at sort of five, what do you want to be? I'd have said that I wanted to be an author. And I was sort of a teenager who wrote a lot of fan fiction. I was very, writing all the time on these massive IBM desktop my parents had. And so I think that time it tapered off a lot as I became an adult, I think, partly because of an absence of confidence in what I was producing and partly, I think, because of practicalities. And I wanted to live in London, and that meant getting a sensible, reliable job. Writing would not have been possible at that point. So it was a few things that I think veered off towards something that was a bit more corporate. And I think I probably did let the writing dream go for about a decade, just because it seemed so improbable. I had to pay the rent as well.
Yeah.
So those were the reasons why I let things go slightly, I think. But it was always in the back of my mind that was what I wanted to do. And I would often, every now and then sort of say to my partner, well, really real dream job would be to be a writer, but that's just, what's the point? And he would say, well, to be a writer, you do have to write something. It is very diplomatic.
I mean, it's a good point, but it's annoying.
Very good point. Brutally made.
Yep.
But ultimately, I think that is the case. That's the horrible truth is you do have to carve out time to write something.
Mm.
And that's where the sort of romance of the dream comes up against the real difficulties of reality when you do have a full-time job and when, you want to use your free time either to collapse on the sofa or to see friends or cats. The horrible truth is those minutes and hours have to be put in.
Yeah, that's it. As you say, it doesn't write itself, unfortunately. And especially that story in your head, you're the only one that can write it. So got to get it out.
Yeah.
It's a testament to how your hard work that you've done that. And not only done that, done an incredibly impressive two books now. And I'm so excited for your third. Unbelievably exciting. But speaking of writing, a new question that I've started asking people is, what's a line that you've written lately or from your past two books that you're especially proud of?
So I should probably say something from day one, but because I have been spending such a lot of time writing book three, all the lines that are currently in my head are book three lines. So I think there's a line, the opening line of book three I can share.
Ooh.
It might change.
Okay.
It probably will change.
I'll do a little asterisk next to it. Caveat.
Yeah. You know, it's just like when you get a proof and it says, you know, not for sharing, not for posting.
Yeah.
Stop. But the opening line of book three is, let me talk again then about the night you came to our house.
Whoa.
So without saying anything else about book three, that's the opening line, which hopefully provides very small clues as to what it is.
I'm intrigued. That is a very intriguing first line. I like that. That could go any number of ways. Very exciting. Oh my God. I have a favorite line from your book, from the new one, from day one. And I don't want to spoil anything either because it's quite near the end. So we can always take it out if we think this is too much of a spoiler. He wrote letters for cigarettes and he gave the cigarettes to the men who asked for them. And for the cigarettes, he lived in their precarious peace, which was less peace than abject boredom. I love that line.
Thank you, Frankie.
Oh,
yeah, because I feel like it's disclosed very early in the novel that Trent spends time in prison.
Yeah.
I don't think it is
okay.
A spoiler. But I didn't want there to be a very long prison section of the book. So it's sort of like, how do you summarize that experience
in
very small chapter, really? So thank you. I'm very grateful to hear that.
I think you captured it so well. And it's something I think that I've never been to prison, for the record, not yet, never been caught. But when you hear about prison dramas, we know that cigarettes are currency there. So that gives it a very kind of real visceral feel to it, because it's whenever you watch a prison drama on TV, for example, it's always smoking, and we know that they use it as so I think you captured the essence of it without having to go into a lot, as you say, of excessive detail about that prison period. And also the fact that he was isolated within that is captured so well in just that one line, which is amazing achievement.
Thank you. And also credit to lots of the prison blogs online.
Oh yeah.
People's accounts about spending time in prison, which were really, really valuable for writing.
Gosh.
We're just trying to kind of capture that in very few words.
No, it's a beautiful line. I thought it was really stayed with me as I read. I was like, oh, I like that one. And you said before we were starting out that you love film and TV and things like that. And this, I think, could easily be a very compelling drama series, perhaps, or something. But how are you finding the process of adapting Girl A?
So I'm not adapting it myself.
Okay.
I should say that straight away. I'm not writing the script.
Yeah.
So I've sort of seen parts of a script, which is very, very exciting. And for me, I find it very liberating that when it comes to a TV or film adaptation, as a writer, you actually you have the option to take a step back.
Yeah.
And you can, I think some writers are incredibly involved in adaptations, and that wasn't my choice for Girl A. So it's sort of really joyful that you get to see your story and your characters in somebody else's hands, really. And I don't find I have a kind of possessive need to dictate how things are done, just because those characters, to me, I left them back in 2019, I think.
Yeah.
And that's kind of great. Like, that, you know, the book is what it is. And I just find it so fascinating that other people have taken something you've created and added even more life to it. Amazing. Yeah,
it's amazing. I think, as you say, it's a very healthy way that you've approached it. So that's lovely. And then you get to enjoy it with everyone else as well that way. You know, it's kind of, even though you know the story so well, you get to enjoy it, the fruits of other people's work, and see how they would adapt it. And that's really exciting.
Yeah, I find it really exciting. And you know, even just the sort of tweak that, I don't think it's sort of any secret that Girl A would be set, it would have a US setting if the TV adaptation kind of proceeds. And even that is such a sort of change. These characters become sort of slightly different versions of themselves. is just fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Well, fingers crossed, because I want to see that. That sounds amazing. And you are an incredibly busy woman. We've established this. Not only that you are writing, you're all over the place, you know, at bookshops, doing everything. You have a child, you have another child on the way. Do you have much time for reading?
More so since leaving work, certainly. And for me, reading is a really important part of the writing process as well. So I know some writers decide not to read new books while they are working on fiction. But for me, I really like to read a lot while I'm writing. And I always have a pile of books on my desk, which I will sort of dip into as I'm writing. If I feel slightly stuck or uninspired, I try to have a kind of book of a sort of pile of books that are not necessarily sort of similar to what I'm trying to write, but maybe have particular strands or atmospheres or characters which tie into some way to what I'm trying to achieve. So I love to kind of dip into other people's work to pull me out of slumps as well.
That's really interesting. Yeah, because I speak to a lot of authors who say that they're so terrified that they're accidentally going to absorb something from someone else's story or whatever. But you're saying it's enhancing your story further, that inspiration from other writers.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I guess an example would be, I feel I'm a writer, I sort of have to subdue the sort of drama. Like, I try to, for me, my tendency will always be to be like overdramatic, I think, in my writing style. And that's something I've really tried to work on over the last decade or so. And I think I looked to someone like Kazuo Shigeru and the way he writes in this very, very moving way.
Mm.
But with sort of great restraint. So that would be an example, I guess, of something where his books are incredibly different from the books I write, but he's a writer I admire so much. And I find it really interesting to see, like, how does he evoke such kind of emotion in the reader with such a kind of, with quite emotionless characters, or certainly characters who don't like to portray their emotion.
Yeah.
So I guess that's an example of where I'll have a book on my desk that's very different from what I'm writing, but it helps me in some way.
And do you read quite broadly across genre?
Yeah, I think so. I love the crime community and I love reading thrillers. I also like reading a lot of books that are sort of traditionally considered more literary. I don't agree with the distinction necessarily that, you know, I understand it from a commercial perspective that it's nice to know which table to go to in bookshop.
Yes.
But, you know, there are some thrillers are written so wonderfully.
Yes.
There's no reason why they should be sort of severed away from the literary community, I don't think. And the same with romance and the same with genres.
Yeah, I think that's, particularly in the last few years, that snobbery, I'm glad, is starting to fall away around genre, because it's so ridiculously old-fashioned and untrue, as you say. There's some incredibly beautifully written crime thrillers out there, and it shows the ignorance of people that say that, who clearly haven't read them if they're saying that, you know? But
yeah, exactly. I totally agree.
Yeah. So what was the last book that you read and loved?
I recently read and loved Megan Nolan's Ordinary Human Failings.
Ooh, I've not read that one.
It's just been shortlisted, I think, for the Woman's Prize. And it is a book that, coming back to our sort of genre overlap, it begins as a thriller in that there's a discovery of a young girl's body on a council estate in London. But it becomes, rather than a sort of investigative piece, it's really about the family who become the sort of object, the object of kind of press scrutiny around what took place. And it's, so it has the sort of thriller element that I love of what happened, but it's also very much loyal to its title. It's about very ordinary human foibles and how misfortune and small tragedies accumulate to make up different lives. It's, you know, very beautifully written and with such kind of empathy, and a real kind of sincerity of empathy. It's a book with a lot of heart, I would say. and also very, very clever. So that I love.
Sounds like you could be describing Day One a bit there as well, I think. All of that's true of your book too.
I'll take that.
All of those parallels are there. So I think, yeah, it sounds like a solid genre to be around, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. I'll have to check that one out. That sounds incredible. But Abigail, I've had such a wonderful time chatting to you. It's been so lovely, but I'm afraid I now have to confront you with a terrible thing that you've done to ruin everything now.
No.
I know. I don't want to have to do this. You seem so nice, but...
That doesn't sound good.
It's not good. It's not good, Abigail. I think you know what I'm talking about because, unfortunately, you've committed a terrible, heinous crime, haven't you, Abigail?
It happens.
It does happen. But it was so terrible and so heinous and shocking in nature that, unfortunately, you have been sentenced to death for it.
Oh,
I know.
Yeah,
what a bummer. I'm really sorry.
Really,
yeah, to bring the mood down with this shocking revelation. What crime do you think you've committed? What's got you here, do you think?
So, I mean, if it's something bad enough to be put to death.
Yeah.
And I assume I've probably murdered somebody, which is not great.
Not great.
But, you know, there are a lot of, there's some irritating people in the world.
There are
people who walk incredibly slowly.
Oh, that is, yeah.
Not okay.
No, I think everyone would agree with that if that's the motive. I think that's fine. It's perfectly reasonable.
Yeah, there's people who don't wear their headphones on public transport.
Correct. Yep.
So, you know, who's committed the real crime here might be the question I ask.
It's a very good question. And you know what? You've actually performed a valuable public service when we think about it, really. So thank you for your service.
Sadly, the judge and jury did not agree.
Exactly. I also love the idea of a newspaper headline that just says, not great that you've murdered someone. But actually, there are at least one or two people now who won't be able to annoy people on a train with their music blaring anymore, thanks to you. So your sacrifice is greatly appreciated. I'm really sorry that you have been sentenced to death, but the good news is I can get you the death row meal of your dreams. So it's not all bad.
It's really not bad.
It's not bad. Not great, not bad. But what would your death row meal be?
So my death row meal would be, I'll be honest, I associate food quite closely with kind of memories and settings.
Perfect.
So I have very strongly agree that eating something outside on like a balmy European evening, it's going to taste better than eating it
on death row.
table. I'm particularly on death row.
Yeah.
Now I'll cast that aside and say I would want a really brilliant roti.
Ooh.
With scrambled egg and cheese, which was the breakfast I had on an island in Malaysia where I was with my husband many years ago. And it was eaten overlooking the beach four mornings in a row. Mm. And I still think about that breakfast as being, I'm a big breakfast person. So the best breakfast for me is like the best meal. So I would go for that, albeit it would probably taste pretty dire in a prison cell.
Well, I can, do you know what though? I will get the chef that made that in Malaysia for you. I'll fly him over. I'll get him in there. We'll make the best of it. We'll do what we can.
Thank you, Frankie. That will help.
Yeah.
And situation.
I'll print out a nice vista of Malaysia to stick up on the wall for you to look at while you eat. Will that help? Yeah.
It'll basically be the same.
You won't even notice the difference.
You won't notice the difference, no.
Exactly. And that sounds incredible. Is there a drink to go with that?
You know what? I'll just go for champagne. Let's just numb the...
Why not?
Let's numb the pain with something something excruciating and expensive.
Numb the pain with champagne. Very nice.
Yes.
Very, very, very apt. That sounds good. And any dessert? Or do you not want dessert with your breakfast?
Possibly, yeah. It's an issue because I'm very much a dessert person.
Oh, same.
But breakfast is pretty much the only meal of the day where you don't necessarily want a dessert.
Why is that, I wonder? I guess so you don't fall asleep at midday, probably, with hindsight.
Honestly, if it was socially acceptable, I would probably do it. But I think for me, it's just that it's not really, it's sort of frowned upon.
Well, do you know what? Maybe this could be our next campaign. This could be our next thing.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I'm going to let you have dessert breakfast this time. So do you have a dessert preference for your... Final meal?
I like very basic desserts. So if my husband was listening to this, he'd be rolling his eyes because if we go to a restaurant and there's anything like deconstructive for dessert or anything that doesn't feature chocolate, essentially, I'm kind of like, oh, it's not really a dessert menu for me. And what that means is it's basically not got a chocolate brownie.
Right.
Or like a steamed coffee pudding on it.
Yeah.
So it would be the real scraping the barrel of your dessert imagination. Yeah, it would probably be a brownie.
Nothing.
A really hot brownie melting ice cream.
Nothing wrong with a classic. That sounds perfect.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yes. Tell your husband, you're absolutely fine. There's no such thing as a wrong dessert, in my opinion, but they're a classic for a reason. They've endured.
They're a classic for a reason. I don't need it taken apart.
No.
No.
Leave it constructed. Leave it full up. Yeah, no, I agree with that. Okay. Fantastic menu. Love that. Delicious. You've had it. And unfortunately, you are now dead. I'm really sorry.
Now's the time.
Yeah. Really, really sad. But, you know, everybody who came to your funeral was wearing their headphones, respectfully, and they walked there at a very brisk pace. Nobody was stuck behind anybody awkwardly dawdling. Yeah. So we honoured you the best way we could. But one more way to honour you is that I will bury you with the book of your choice. So more good news. What book would you be buried with?
This is tough. On the basis that I'll go with a book that I have read because I'm very unlikely to wake up. I mean, obviously everyone has that recurring nightmare,
yes.
But let's assume that's not going to happen here.
Sure.
They've checked pretty comprehensively. So I would probably be buried with The Road by Cormac McCarthy, which is my favourite novel.
Yeah.
And which so beautifully balances incredible darkness with real hope and light. And that's something that I'd hope that all my books can achieve to some degree, that seeing the light in very, very dark, difficult situations. So I'll go for The Road.
That's a great choice. And you definitely have achieved that, I would say, in both of the books that I've read. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And that's, yeah, a fantastic pick. I don't think we've had that one, weirdly, which is strange because it's a... Actually, no, Chris Whitaker picked that one, I think, as well.
Did he?
Yeah.
I'm a big Chris Whitaker fan. I've just finished his...
Oh, it's good, isn't it?
His new novel.
It's really good.
So, yeah. Yeah, I'm glad. I'm okay to share The Road with Chris.
Okay, well, I can, yeah, you have your own copy. I won't like make you share his, but yeah, no, that is a good choice. Fantastic. Well, Abigail, I've had such a lovely time chatting to you. Thank you so much for coming on. And I'm so excited for day one to be out and for people to read it. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great to chat. And thank you for having me on.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. Where can people follow you online?
So I am Abigail S. Dean on both Instagram and X. I am on Instagram a significant amount more than I am on Twitter. So that's where to find me.
Better for one's sanity. I think that's very smart.
Yes. Yeah. I've done my conspiracy theory research and can step away.
Very smart, very sensible. Well, thank you so much. And thank you to everybody for listening. I'll be back soon with another episode. But before then, Abigail, another thing is I never know how to end an episode of this show. It's very awkward. How shall we finish this conversation?
Oh, gosh.
No pressure.
That's a lot of pressure.
No, it's all,
you've got more experience on this than I have, frankly.
You think, but no, yet still here where I am every time. No idea.
Well, let's finish in that wonderful way which you get to put when you finally finished your book, where you just say the end.
Perfect.
How would you like to challenge your little grey cells while reveling in the vintage perfection of David Suchet's Poirot?
If so, then the Labours of a Hercule podcast was made for you.
We're taking a deep dive into every episode of this masterpiece of television and giving you the clues you need to solve the case along with Poirot himself.
We present the case and you solve it.
Whether you're a detective in the making,
or if you just simply want to gush over the genius and art decadence of Agatha Christie,
then subscribe now to the Labours of Hercule, wherever you get your podcasts.